From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the second day of March 2017. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker. He's at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. Matt Bennett will join us too from Bennett Consulting, Channel Seeds out of Windsor, Illinois. We'll discuss the cash grain situation with him on the ground there in his part of the farming country. And as we wrap up our time together, Mike Tatura will take us on a tour the global growing regions and weather conditions in Brazil and California, and what those conditions in California might mean for the Midwest this summer, right here on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Thursday afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Don't forget to pick up your tickets to the All Ag Outlook. Still can do that. They're just $30. That includes your rolling coffee in the morning, the noon meal from the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. A baker's dozens worth of agricultural analysts will take up the commodity markets and the farm bill. We'll do the weather too. Eric Snodgrass will be there, and so will Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. Tickets are just $30, 800-898-1065 or willag.org. Dan is making his way through the great state of Illinois now. Thanks, Dan, for taking some time with us this afternoon as you travel up here for the meeting next week. We do appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing my old acquaintances and friends at the Beef House come Tuesday.
Yeah, so it's a bit colder here than it was there. If I'd known you were going to travel in today, I would have had you stop at Litchfield. I was there this morning with Merrill Crowley and Sherm Newlin and Chip Nellinger. We had a great panel discussion this morning about the marketplace. And boy, there are an awful lot of things to talk about fundamentally. Rumors out of Washington, D.C., and then, of course, the technical side. And I want you to start with that for me because things moved pretty sharply earlier in the week, and especially for the beans. We're back down now. Tell me about it, please.
Well, technically, the markets look real good after the Tuesday-Wednesday run-up in prices. Now, anytime you had that type of emotional trade that we saw there on Tuesday and Wednesday on rumors that took the trade by surprise, it's not uncommon to have a consolidation day. And I think the way I would view today's softness as such, now the key is that the market finds support tomorrow and finish out the week maybe at least steady or on a firm note. And if we do that, then we've got nice weekly reversals to the upside on corn, soybeans, and wheat. That does imply then the market is ripe then for a move higher as we go into the first part of the growing season. Now, we'll have a couple hurdles to get through. We've got, I think, a crop report coming at us next week. And then, of course, the BIC report at the end of the month that'll give us grain stocks on hand as of March 1st, and of course, planting intentions, or at least the initial look at planting intentions. But from a technical perspective, the trend in corn is solidly higher. You just draw trend lines every time it breaks. If you step up there and buy it, you're a winner. Being long corn ever since basically late summer, early fall, corn has been been real well. Wheat has been kind of all over the place, but wheat is trying to carve out a decent uptrend. Soybeans, I would probably call them more of a sideways type market, but I think if we can close out the week strong, soybeans are maybe in a good position to move forward as we go on into the spring months.
What are we hearing, if anything, or maybe you have an opinion, as it relates to acreage that producers will put into the ground? I know USDA Ag Outlook had some numbers last week. Do your numbers differ very much from what they're telling us?
Well, I think you have to go along with what USDA put out. I mean, I think, plus or minus a million on either side of their estimates, you know, who knows? But the corn-soybean ratio has definitely signaled to farmers to plant more soybeans. Now, to what extent, you know, that's the big question. Now, I think there's a lot of acres that could easily be moved back to corn, probably depending upon if corn could gather enough momentum to punch above the $4 mark in these corn and travel up into that 420 to 440 area, I think you would probably swing some corn acres back very quickly, because farmers prefer corn if they can. But just based upon what prices have been offered. Now, farmers, I do think, I mean, every Tom, Dick, and Harry, professional and unprofessionally licensed commodity trading advisors have told farmers to sell these new crop $10 beans hard. Now, so farmers probably do have some $10 beans or better on the books. Now, how aggressive they've gotten and got themselves committed to planting soybean acres, that's another big question. But as much talk and as many people that have advised farmers to sell $10 soybeans, I would think that would be wrong in the long run. But I understand the economics of why they would do that, at least at this point, or put some kind of downside price protection, because it is the most attractive of the three crops what we have right now. But I just think longer term, this market is probably going to be a lot stronger than a lot of people give it credit for. And I think what we saw this week was just an example of what's going to happen to this market from time to time. And we'll just have to see how ag policy plays out. And then, of course, the most critical is going to be weather. And, of course, now the dry spot now is basically in the southern plains. And it'll be interesting to see what happens as we get further into spring, whether or not the dry spot moves north, and then whether or not that has an impact on production prospects as we go through the growing season.
We'll talk to you again in about 35, 40 minutes for Commodity Week, and we'll post that to the website, Dan, and look forward to seeing you over the Beef House next Tuesday.
Very well.
Dan Zwicker is with Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas, joins us here on the Closing Market Report, and will be at the Beef House next week. You can get your tickets at willag.org, 800-898-1065. Don't wait. Buy them right now. Up next, we'll talk with Aaron Hager, weed scientist here at the University of Illinois in Extension. He'll talk about dicamba and dicamba soybeans. Aaron, thanks for being with me. First, can you give me some history of dicamba? How long has this product been around?
Well, I believe the original discoverer, the holder of the original patent for dicamba, was a company called Velsicol. And if I remember correctly, I think it was first patented, I think, back in sometime in the early to mid-1960s. Commercialization, I believe, was either late 1960s or 1970s across, I guess, most of the corn-growing areas of the U.S. Certainly a compound that was originally developed for use in corn and in other grass crops such as, you know, pasture areas and things such as that. So material really that's been around for a long time, extensively used in various formulations in crops such as corn here in Illinois for many, many decades. And now the dicamba-resistant soybean is now a technology that would potentially expand the use of dicamba into soybean, which just so happens to be a crop that in a non-transformed or non-GMO state is still extremely sensitive to dicamba.
How sensitive is that crop to dicamba?
It's one of the most sensitive broadleaf species that's grown in Illinois. You can look in the literature and find studies that have been done now for 40 or 50 years, really trying to look at how sensitive soybean are. You know, the take-home message is that, recent work out of Missouri, I think down to a rate of 1/20,000th of a field use rate, they were able to induce symptoms of exposure to dicamba. But we need to remember, of course, that even though we see symptoms, that may or may not always translate into an adverse affected yield at the end of the growing season, because ultimately, whether or not yield is impacted is going to depend on a lot of variables. Number one, of course, is what dose were the soybean plants exposed to? And another very critical element in this equation is at what growth stage were the soybean when this exposure took place? So we could literally have the same rate of exposure to dicamba in soybean at a early vegetative stage and see no effect at the end of the year. And then if we would take that same dose and expose the soybean at a much later growth stage, say at one of the reproductive stages, the likelihood of seeing an adverse effect on yield is then much, much higher and much more likely.
So we're likely to have this in, I suppose, a lot of soybeans across the state, people who are looking to control, in particular, mare's tail. That was a problem. It was a problem primarily for, I think, no-tillers, but last year that developed into a problem for everybody across the state.
Actually, we saw as many escapes of mare's tail and soybean farther north in Illinois in 2016 than we've ever seen before. Now, we have to admit that we really have not screened our mare's tail populations from Illinois to determine whether or not or what percentage of these plants are actually resistant to glyphosate, which is a very common component in many burndowns. But looking at the phenotype of these plants after they're sprayed in the field, they look almost identical to what we normally associate a phenotype of a glyphosate-resistant mare's tail plant. So we assume, of course, and this could be a fairly large assumption, that a lot of our mare's tail is now glyphosate resistant. So a tank mix or a combination burn down has been used for many, many years in Illinois, something like glyphosate 2,4-D. If the glyphosate is no longer effective, the 2,4-D by itself in these mixes is generally going to pretty much struggle with trying to control the mare's tail by itself. So dicamba, on the other hand, we've got a lot of data. Other universities has quite a bit of data also that would indicate that it can be a very strong material to control mare's tail and burn down ahead of a no-till soybean planting. With the dicamba soybean technology, this actually allows for the opportunity to use dicamba at a fairly good rate for mare's tail control, and we really don't have those plant back restrictions that we do on other dicamba formulations that we need to adhere to before planting a non-dicamba soybean.
And so this is one of the big differences, non-dicamba soybean versus the dicamba soybean. And it sounds to me as if this is a pretty good burndown product. You'd be okay with using it ahead of time. However, there are a lot of label restrictions. Once we get in season, that change everything, especially if you're going to spray this onto a dicamba-resistant soybean. Mm-hmm.
Actually, some of these label restrictions even do cover the pre-plant or pre-emergence timing as well. You know, we'll give one example. If we're looking at like the Roundup the Extendamax label, which is a straight dicamba formulation from Monsanto, if there's a requirement to have a buffer area, a downwind buffer area, the size of that buffer area would vary depending on the rate that's applied. So an in-crop application of up to a half a pound of dicamba acid would require a 110-foot buffer. However, if we're using dicamba now in this pre-plant or this pre-emergence time frame, if we're allowed to go up to a full pound of dicamba at that application, well, if we do that, now that buffer goes to 220 feet. So these restrictions on the label, there'll be restrictions not only in the in-crop application, but certainly some that would extend also into the pre-plant or pre-emergence application timing also.
There's only one nozzle that can be used for dicamba application. Is this post and pre-emergence both?
That is correct. The supplemental label that governs the use of dicamba with dicamba resistant soybean, there is only one nozzle that is approved for use. That could change in the future, but folks need to really be aware that going into 2017, there is only one right now.
Yeah, and approved means not recommended. It means approved.
It means approved, and I've heard conversations of people who have gone through these labels, and I've heard them say, well, we recommend this nozzle, or we recommend this boom height, or we recommend several things, but these are not necessarily recommendations. These are restrictions on the label. When I think of a recommendation, it's me giving somebody a piece of advice, and they can choose whether or not they want to follow that advice or not. These statements on these labels are not recommendations. These are things that must be followed every time these applications are made. So, for example, if you elect not to follow something like the nozzle selection type or the height of the boom above the crop canopy, you are now violating this federal law, this federal label.
Is it the height of the boom above the crop canopy or above ground level?
Be above the crop canopy.
Yeah, so it says 24 inches. So, but normally when the crop's in the field, at what height would you be spraying?
It's going to depend on your nozzle spacing as well as the angle of the nozzles, but usually you're in that 24 to 36 inch range.
Yeah. This is low. And this is a lot lower than applicators would normally go, probably a lot lower than most farmer applicators would go, right? So this is going to cause a problem, and they have to go slow too.
Yeah, there's even maximum application speeds that are listed on the label. I believe you cannot exceed, I think it's 15 miles an hour during the actual application. You know, a few other things that come to mind that maybe not everybody's aware of. If you have precipitation in the forecast for the next 24 hours, you're not allowed to make an application. There's concern about if we make the application, if some comes in contact with soil, for example, if we get into a heavy rainfall event the day afterward, we may physically move some of that out of the field through the process of soil erosion and have it deposited in an area that could be harboring an endangered dicot species, for example.
And then there's the whole volatility thing, which relates to how well this drifts. And it's going to be a problem. Already has been a problem.
Well, and we see a lot in the farm press, we hear a lot from the manufacturers about low volatility formulations, whether it be the Roundup, or I'm sorry, the Xtendimax with the Vapor Grip or the Ingenia. And, you know, one thing to remember, even though these products are low volatility or what the companies claim have reduced volatility, that does not mean there's no volatility. And that's something that folks really need to be aware of. These products can have the potential, and they do have the potential, to still volatilize. And volatility is something that is very, very concerning, because really once that material changes from a gas to a vapor, it literally can move wherever the wind's going to move it to.
And there's an inversion restriction as well.
There's inversion restrictions on there as well. You're not to make an application under conditions of inversion, which are typically occur under very low wind speeds. Many times they'll begin late in the afternoon or early evening and extend until the early morning hours. So even, you know, for example, about how important inversion conditions can be, one of the label restrictions would say if the wind is blowing, if there's no wind at all, if winds are calm, you're not allowed to make the application.
Thank you so much. We'll, I'm sure, be in contact with you during the growing season to see how this progresses, not only here in the state of Illinois, but around the Midwest.
Okay. Thank you, Todd.
Aaron Hager is a weed scientist at the University of Illinois. You can read more from him on the Bulletin website at bulletin.ipm.illinois.edu. This is the Closing Market Report for Thursday afternoon. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason, joined now by Mike Tenor at T-Storm Weather in Chicago. Thanks, Mike, for being with us. Can you start in Brazil for me this afternoon, where the weather has been a little on the wet side?
They certainly have, especially in those northern areas. Those northern areas stay fairly wet over the next 2 weeks. We see a number of cool fronts that are moving on to the north now, and those will dissipate across Brazil over the next couple of weeks. That will lead to areas of thunderstorms pretty much every day in one region or another going forward. Now, a lot of people always talk about Brazil and how they have a wet climate, and while that certainly is the case, this is a little bit wet even for them. They average around 6 to 8 inches of rain in the month of March, and we're looking for 3.5 to 7 inches of rain over the next couple of weeks on top of what's been a pretty wet period over the last 4 to 5 weeks on top of that. So pretty much staying wet in northern Brazil over the next 2 weeks. After that, we'll probably start to dry out because, remember, their climate turns sharply drier from mid-March forward, and we expect that at some point here we'll start to see this pattern break down as they move into their dry season.
Now work your way south from there to Argentina, please.
Well, once we get into Argentina, they've had some wetness issues at one point or another, either in January or February, and even a few locations in Argentina are pretty wet now. If you look at Bolivar in Buenos Aires, they've received 15 inches of rain over the last 30 days. That's a measured total, too. So a lot of rain has occurred in a few locations, but unlike what we saw back in January, we don't have high coverage of these real high amounts, just localized areas that are too wet. And they look to stay a little wet going forward as well. A few thunderstorms today and tomorrow, then about 5 days of dry weather, then another cool front or two move through around March 9th and 10th. So more rain in Argentina as well, but not quite as wet as what we've seen previously.
Speaking of wet, the last couple of months, the rainfalls in California have broken the drought there. Can you tell me about it and maybe the future impact it might have across the United States, if any?
Well, if you take a look at January and February rainfall across the state of California, it's more than likely that that period will have been the wettest since before 1895. So we'll have broken a record that had stood for over 123 years. Now, there have been a lot of other real wet periods since 1895. So even though it's been unusual, it certainly has not been unprecedented. And one of the more interesting features of the wetness there is that when we see these wet periods, they tend to get clustered, and we don't really know why that is. But if you look back in history, you'll see that the period from 1906 to 1916 was unusually wet a lot in January and February. So was the period of 1936 to 41 and 1993 to 2000. Now, since 2000, we haven't had this happen. This was the first time. So that was 17 years between a real wet type of winter and the last one. And that's the longest gap other than 1940 to 1958. So the point here is that even though it has been unusual, it certainly has not been unprecedented. It just has been a while since we've seen this. Now, if you take a look at what followed in those growing seasons across the U.S. Corn Belt, there's not a lot to grab onto. You can see some good crop years followed for corn and soybeans. You can see some bad crop years followed. But there just isn't a real tendency to see one type of yield scenario or another, which tells us as a meteorologist there just isn't a whole lot there that is going to be signified by this. You can't say, oh, it was wet in California, so now we have a drought coming or we have a great summer coming. We just don't know. The only thing that is a little bit interesting is that if you isolate out the soybean yields that occurred in these periods that were unusually wet, there weren't too many real good soybean crops. The best that we saw was about 2 bushels an acre, or 2 bushels per acre above trend at the U.S. level, which would be a yield of around 48 bushels per acre this year. That was the best we did with 11 possible observations. Most of the yields were lower than that, or actually all of them were lower than that. So that just tells us that maybe soybeans don't have an ideal growing season coming up. But again, it's real tough to draw a lot of conclusions here.
Hey, thanks, Mike.
You're welcome, Todd. Have a great day.
And of course, as Mike Tenora, he's with T-Storm Weather out of Chicago, joins us on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm UofI Extension's Todd Gleason.